I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 3rd of April. You're familiar with this story. It's the three young Americans who were imprisoned in Iran, Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Shord. They were on vacation hiking in the hills over Iraqi Kurdistan, which was deemed to be a great place to go on vacation. It was 100 miles from Iran, they thought, and a soldier beckoned them over to him. They unwittingly crossed the border into Iran, and they were captured and imprisoned as spies. And they were there for a long, long period of time. The book that the three of them have written, they each take a segment and it goes from one segment to another looks at solitary confinement, looks at the political situation between Iran and the United States. It looks at friendship and how you construct all these elaborate ways to communicate with each other. And of course, the big question of how in the world you can remain sane under such circumstances. And the circumstances were a long, long time, particularly for the two gentlemen, Shane and Joshua, and for Sarah as well. What were the efforts that took place outside the prison to free them? And of course, they didn't know about all of this as well. Were they successful? Who was asked for help? Who wasn't asked for help, who was most helpful, who was not helpful. The book is A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, and we shortly will be speaking. We're just trying to make connections with all of our guests so that we can talk about this. The book is really very captivating. All three of these young people are very, very good writers. Let me just introduce them until we get to them on the phone. Joshua Fatal is a historian. He has a background in environmental sustainability. Before his arrest in Iran, he taught in Asia the political economy of healthcare. He was co-director of an environmental education center in Oregon. He has taught nonviolent communication. He resides right now in Brooklyn with his partner and child. And oh, he is with us. All right. So, Joshua, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're trying to reach Sarah and Josh, and we will, and Shane, and we will shortly. So let me just start with you, and we'll meet Sarah and Shane as soon as we can. So here, why don't we start with taking this hike? I mean, a lot of people have criticized all of you for taking this hike in this really dangerous part of the world. It turns out, as you write in the book, that this is quite a tourist destination. It's supposed to be very beautiful.
Yeah, it is a beautiful place. You know, a lot of people have an issue with Americans traveling to the Middle East, and, and I think that in and of itself is pretty misguided. You know, I found that I was there for a short time because I was just visiting my friends who had been living there for a year or so. But it was extremely warm, and then other people have you know, criticized us for traveling to Iraq and Kurdistan. But really there, I found people, when we got there, the hotel manager, I remember, the first guy I met in Iraqi Kurdistan was telling me the merits of the U.S. government and the Israeli government. So it was a very kind of pro-American area with a lot of Europeans. But, you know, so then when we wanted to get out of town, we went to we asked people and they told us to go to this waterfall. And it was there that I think, you know, maybe we deserve a little bit of criticism, but I do feel like we probably paid the price for whatever mistake we did.
Yes.
We went to this waterfall. There were tons of families there. And it was just, you know, like local people who go to their nearby waterfall. But then we hiked beyond it, not knowing that we were so close to a border region with Iran. And we actually ended up, like, hiking right on the border. For a moment, we stepped onto Iran. For a moment, we stepped back onto the border. And eventually, we ran into we saw a border guard in the distance we had no idea that we were near the border, but we later found out that that's where we were. And this border guard called us to him, and we found out that we were then in Iran. Pretty much immediately, he takes us down the hill. They drive us down the hill, and, you know, we have to, like, buy Sarah a hijab because, you know, we're not prepared to be in clothes like we were in Iran, and, you know, it's illegal without a head covering for a woman. And so they took us down the hill, and I remember they took us to a police station, and outside the police station, one of the bureaucrats there was kind of going on this tirade about how, you know, what the U.S. has done to Iranians and how it had recently imprisoned Iranians for over 2 years, and that, you know, potentially we'd be used as retaliation. I remember just thinking at the time that, wow, you know, that's between the U.S. government and my government. That's, like, not anything, you know, that's not me. I wasn't,
right.
You know.
It's not you.
So, and I also remember him shouting, 2 years, 2 years, and me thinking, well, okay, well, nothing like that would happen. That was really just a few hours into a little bit over 2 years of detention for me.
And we do have Sarah and Shane with us now, I believe. Sarah and Shane, are you there?
Yeah.
All right. There you go. We've been talking to Josh for a little bit. Let me introduce both of you as well. Sarah, all three of these people have written the book together, and each is a very accomplished writer. It's a gripping story. Sarah is a writer, educator, contributing editor at Solitary Watch, visiting scholar at UC Berkeley. And we thank you, Sarah, very much for being with us. And Shane Bauer is also with us. Sarah and Shane are now married. He's an investigative journalist and photographer based in Oakland. He speaks Arabic. His work has focused on the Middle East and North Africa, as well as criminal justice in the United States. Shane, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
And Josh has talked about, you know, where you were hiking and how you were called over. When did it appear to both of you that this was not really about you? This was about a political situation and a long history between Iran and the United States. So essentially, whatever protest you had or whatever your truth was, which must have been apparent to a lot of people that you were innocent people, didn't make much difference.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the early weeks and even early months, I just couldn't bring myself to believe that this was going to last. I took it one day at a time. I thought it could be another day, it could be another week at the very longest. But after 2 months of interrogation, my interrogator called me into the room where we were interrogated, which was small room, windowless, with padded walls, and we'd always be blindfolded sitting in.
Wait, before you continue, we're having a problem hearing you.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah. Is there another microphone you can use? No.
Well,
there we go, Shane.
I can take
okay.
over.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, it seems better now. I think it's. Just to finish my story, I was saying after 2 months of interrogation, my interrogator called me in, and he's up to that point.
Yeah, before you. I think it's Josh who will have to take over because we can't hear you. Is that you, Josh? I'm sorry, everybody.
I'm here.
Okay.
Here, yeah.
You've heard what she said. You'll have to carry on. After 2 months, she realized.
Yeah, the interrogators had told us that, you know, we're innocent, we know you're innocent, and it's become political, is kind of how they framed it. You know, and at that point, it's between your government and our government. And at that point, you know, it was soon after that that I remember hearing about these Belgians and these Germans that were nearby me in the cell. We're isolated, but sometimes it sneak some information and get some news, and eventually we got a TV. And, you know, they were in similar situations, and the German foreign minister flew to Iran, spent a few days talking and negotiating, and flew back with the prisoners. And so I kind of had this feeling of, oh, no, you know, we don't have diplomatic relations with Iran. It's, you know, something between our government could drag on forever.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the experience, Josh, which is hard for those of us who have not been in it to imagine. You're in a cell. You are completely innocent. People are accusing you of being spies, which obviously you weren't. You're trying to let them know on many levels who you really are, and some will believe you and some won't. But you're also dealing with, you know, isolation and not speaking a language and going a little bit crazy because you're in this cell all day long. Psychologically, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, certain, you know, I've talked to people, you know, trying to explain, you know, what it was like and write about what it's like with people. And you know what the crazy part is that, you know, ultimately I'm dealing with, you know, the only thing I'm dealing with most of the time is my own mind. Because, and
right.
my own body, I just want to, trying to keep my body healthy, do a little bit of exercise and try to eat enough. And then it's just me, four walls, and my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's, you know, there's some interrogations and things that are really horrific and are very much, you know, foreign to me and so, you know, takes a moment for me to get used to saying my interrogator. But like the overwhelming experience is something that I think what a lot of people can relate to on a certain level, but in just extreme conditions, because just that level of isolation left me really just alone with my mind. And what I did was I went and just thought about, you know, everything from my past. I tried to think about the future. And, you know, what happens in that circumstance is that, like, I tried to understand what was happening, trying to understand that, like, I'm being punished. Like, why am I being punished? There has to be some reason for it. And I just would think about the past and feel all this regret for, you know, everything from, you know, the hike, but also to just, like, you know, last phone call I had with my mother, I should have been more loving to her. I mean, you know, every little thing.
Right.
And then the future is just, you know, this object of fear. You know, what are they going to do with me? You know, how long is this going to take? And will I make it out alive? These sort of basic questions. And the present, which is all around me, is just sort of bare bones and blank. So it becomes this sort of intolerable situation of when to live in.
Right. And you knew, you could hear, you and Shane, that people were being tortured within the walls of the prison or outside the walls of the prison.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much within the first weeks, because the first 4 months, all three of us were completely isolated and in solitary confinement, or at least largely isolated, but in solitary confinement from the very beginning. Shane and I were put together after 4 months, and Sarah remained in solitary confinement for her 14 months until she was released. It took another year for Shane and I to be released from our same cell. And from a few weeks, I heard, it was really vicious torture and screaming and pain, something I'd never heard before. And it just, you know, sounded horrible. But it happened in different ways in different times. You know, it wasn't like an everyday thing, but it would happen occasionally. And I remember one time when Shane and I were in the cell together, there would be a guy being quite close to us. And Shane and I ran to the door of the cell and started pounding on it, trying to make a little bit of commotion to distract the guards. And they stopped beating the prisoner and came to us to tell us to be quiet. They really don't like when we bang on the doors. And we said, you know, what is this, Guantanamo Bay?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, and they looked so kind of embarrassed and insulted by such a thought that one time they actually stopped beating the prisoner for it.
Mm. Did you at some point think that that was going to be you who was going to be beaten and killed?
Yeah, I mean, at the beginning, when I first heard the screams, I remember I was in a courtyard. I was allowed to spend 2 half-hour sessions in this courtyard, blindfolded, running up and down, up and back this one lane of the courtyard. And that was my exercise during the day. But in the middle of my session there, these screams just started happening from just over the wall. And I just remember stopping dead in my tracks and feeling sick in my stomach, not knowing, you know, who's next, and not really knowing just the nature of the place that I was in. You know, it was just a few weeks. As time went by and the sort of message of it's become political kind of sunk in on different levels,
mm-hmm.
it became clear that we were hostages in this way,
right.
And that they, you know, they were psychologically torturing us. You know, it's like UN is saying now that 15 days in solitary can be considered torture. And that was over 100 days. But they didn't want to physically torture us because we're valuable. And as that message sunk in, it allowed this little bit of leeway, for instance, that story I mentioned with the other prisoner getting beaten and Shane and I kind of questioning the guard about, you know, accusing him of being like Guantanamo Bay. We were able to do that. We were empowered to do that because we knew he wouldn't then turn the wrath on us.
Right. You knew that you had that leeway, which allowed you to perhaps get a little bit of what you wanted, like being able to see each other and being able to get letters, so you would go on hunger strike, and they didn't want you to get really sick because you were on hunger strike, right?
Yeah, no, it's such a mix because, you know, we were probably isolated in some ways longer than some Iranian prisoners. we were isolated more from news sources, from being able to make phone calls out.
Right.
And other Iranian prisoners, we were isolated from other prisoners, you know, in a way. But we were given sort of materially better treatment. You know, we weren't physically harmed. Okay. So, yeah, so I was just talking, saying that we had the difference between Iranian prisoners and us. And so we were materially safer in those ways.
Yeah. Let's welcome phone calls, but first let's reintroduce him. We'll do that in just a moment. I'm sorry, we've had some problems getting everybody on the air. Sarah and Shane will be with us on the phone in just one moment. They, of course, are the other two young people who are in Iran, and the three, Shane and Sarah and Josh, have written about their experiences and their thoughts about the politics of the situation, which we have yet to talk about in great detail, about pleas for help that went out from their family members, and they didn't know about this, all that they learned once they were released, and how they may have fallen on deaf ears, and what their thoughts are about what will keep these kinds of situations from happening and why it is there are so many who are imprisoned in solitary confinement and in not very good conditions in the United States and all over the world. The book is A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. We'll take phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have established phone contact now with Shane and with Sarah, so let's talk with them. And Josh is on the phone with us as well. Sarah and Shane, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure.
Thank you.
The story has advanced a little bit. At what point did you realize there may be people working on your behalf? And how much did you know, if anything, about who was working on your behalf?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the first time that I realized that, I mean, of course, on an abstract level, I used to try to convince myself there's no way we're going to be forgotten. I mean, it was 6 months before we even had a phone call. So I hadn't heard my mother's voice. She hadn't heard my voice. There's plenty of room there for horrible nightmares to take over, and doubt did take over the majority of the time. But other prisoners were the first way that I learned a little taste of what was happening on the outside. There was a woman, an older woman in her 60s, who was in a cell next to mine, and she recognized me. And when she would walk past my cell, I would look through the food slot, and she would look at me under her blindfold, and she told me, "I saw your mother on TV. You know, be strong. Mm. She's fighting." And that was like, I just jumped up and down and danced around my cell for hours after that. It was one of the most ecstatic moments I'd had for many months.
Mm. And later on, I believe you found out that woman had been executed, right?
That's actually a different woman.
Was it?
Yeah, really, dozens of different interactions. Zahra was the woman that was later executed, was my closest friend, because she was just, she was fearless. She broke prison rules. Nothing could stop her. Nothing could break her. And we had a clandestine letter writing correspondence for several weeks, and her main message was just, please don't hate Iranian people. You know, we hate our government. Look what our government's doing to us. You know, basically, we're on the same side. And she and I planned on meeting each other in the Netherlands. She was half Dutch, and spending days together dancing and telling each other stories from our entire lives. And she was executed just a couple months after I was released.
Mm. Shane, what about the efforts that we were making to get you all released? When you heard about the attempts that had been made, who did people in your family and others contact, and why do you feel now that people just didn't do very much who were asked to help?
Well, I think a lot of people did a lot. You know, we had a whole campaign for our release, our families, our friends, so many people that we didn't even know. I mean, when I got out of prison, I was constantly, and I still meet people that, for the first time, that, you know, worked tirelessly on my behalf to get me out of prison, not just in the United States, but around the world. I think, you know, our families at some point were getting frustrated with the, you know, lack of urgency they felt from our government in trying to get us out. And there were times that after Sarah got out, for example, she was getting
direct messages from President Ahmadinejad through an Omani envoy. And there were, you know, several times that small gestures were suggested that would have been enough to have Josh and I released. For example, there was one time where President Ahmadinejad said that if President Obama wrote a letter to him, kind of an innocuous letter saying that, you know, that he hoped for better relations between the U.S. and Iran in the future, that would have been enough to release us. But it didn't go anywhere. And, I mean, we're talking about decades of hostility that needed to be overcome just to take these basic steps of kind of reaching out. And there was no will on either side at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to note that those kind of small gestures, one of the reasons I was so incredibly frustrated after my release when I joined the campaign, you know, we got all this high-level attention, meetings with President Obama, President Clinton, Secretary Clinton. The gestures we were asking for, like what Shane mentioned about a letter from the president and his counterpart in Iran, would have helped. Those kind of small gestures would have helped speed up diplomacy and helped people on both sides. It wouldn't have just been beneficial to our case and gotten Shane and Josh out. But there was just no political will to change this relationship of hostility that benefits no one. And now, a few years later, that relationship has changed. There's a historic nuclear deal. It's at least, you know, a provisional deal that is going to ease sanctions. And the two governments are talking. And it's, you know, just how much suffering has happened that it took decades to get to this point.
But why would it be that a letter, the saying what you just said, from Obama to Ahmadinejad may have been able to get you released? Why?
Well, I think there's a lot of, you know, ways to speculate about this. But, you know, Iran was basically holding us to get something from the United States. And, you know, initially what they wanted was to do a prisoner exchange, and that didn't work. And they were holding us to look powerful. They, you know, the U.S. would demand our release, and they would say no, and that gave them power in a sense. And I think it got down to the point where it was something easy that they could at least get something back after releasing Sarah. And this was something that, you know, didn't seem like it would be a huge effort.
And it's not a guarantee of engagement, but it makes the possibility of engagement that much more likely. And anyone who's been to Iran or knows much about Iran, Iranian people are some of the most pro-American people in the entire Middle East. And we found that out, ironically, in prison. I mean, other people would yell they loved me down the hallway. The other political prisoners would push past the guards and throw their arms around me.
Mm.
They don't believe, they want their government to change. And now that Rouhani has initiated diplomacy with the U.S., he's very popular among his own people for doing that. So I'm sure President Ahmadinejad would have loved that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about, Josh, go ahead.
Well, let me just add, you know, even the letter itself is sort of an act of engagement, and would have been. And the Iranian government, like the U.S. government, likes to act like they're forcing the Americans to come to the table. You know, the American government says, we put sanctions on them for so long until they finally came to the table. The Iranian government does the same thing. They say, you know, they want to, within their own media, they say, you know, we forced America to come to the table and negotiate with us. So that would have been a way to save face and look that way.
Mm-hmm. The one thing that I can't imagine you're having to put up with, you went through this trial and all this information is given and defense lawyers and others are saying to you, it's so obvious that you are not spies. You don't speak Farsi. You didn't have the proper headgear. I mean, how could you possibly be spies, even though they combed through everything and tried to figure out some reason to make you spies? Didn't it drive you all a little crazy to have all these people saying you were something that you knew? It's like, of course I didn't do this. I'm innocent. I'm innocent. I am not a spy. And yet they continued to think you were spies.
Well, you know, the interesting thing was that in our world, in prison, there wasn't any of that. I mean, every guard I asked, you know, if they thought I was a spy, they all said no.
Right.
The interrogator said no. I mean, it was just, it was understood in that place, in the political prison, that this is a dirty game. This is just how it goes. It was only in the outside world, and when we actually went to court, that we were really faced with that, you know, that accusation in any kind of serious way. And even then, it was just so obviously fraud that, you know, it just didn't matter. And this was a lesson that we learned inside prison, too, was that truth didn't matter, you know.
Right.
It's not what it was about. Our interrogations would just go through all kinds of ridiculous questions, and, you know, we learned early on that it was just a politics game.
And even,
you know, I met a guy last night who was convinced that I was a spy, and it sort of shows, I just kind of was amazed looking at him, an American guy, because, you know, like Shane said, the Iranian captors, Iranian guards didn't think so, but of course there are, you know, some people here who still thought so.
Some who was this person?
Just somebody. He came to a book signing of that.
Right.
I think Iranians in general, they have Iranians all around the world in diaspora and inside Iran have been some of our greatest supporters. And when our moms came to visit Tehran, people in the street came up to them and apologized to them on behalf of their government. And, you know, I've heard that hundreds of times.
Even the border guard apologized to Sarah over Facebook.
Right.
And President Ahmadinejad told her that he knew that we were innocent.
Yeah. Yeah, the border guard that had he spoke some English, and he had an English-Farsi dictionary. And when I said, you guys called us into Iran, you know, we didn't come in willingly, he said, you are true, you are true.
Mm.
And then 2 years later, he contacted me on Facebook, and of course, at first, I didn't believe that it was the same guy, but he knew every single detail of our conversation. He'd obviously played it again and again in his
head. Remarkable.
He felt really bad about it. He said, you know, I hope you're okay, and he confirmed that we were called into Iran.
Mm. You write, all of you do. You're such remarkable writers. Sarah, this caught my attention. You talk about being in the cell with one book. You're by yourself. You have a wool blanket. And this whole process of starting to degenerate mentally. What was that like for you, and how did you combat that?
Well, obviously, I didn't, going in, I had no idea how to combat it. I had to make it up as I went along, just day by day. And in the beginning, my mind really deteriorated a lot. And emotionally, I would fluctuate between serious depression, where I didn't get out of bed for days, didn't want to eat, to bouts of rage, and moments of total detachment, disassociation, which is what people do when they're, you know, in states of true psychological trauma, is they disassociate. And I at once was crouched in the corner of my cell, and I heard screaming, and I thought, whoever that prisoner is, I can't help them. I wish they would just stop. I can't stand to listen to this anymore. And I covered my ears, and the guards burst in and started shaking me, and I realized I'd been screaming and beating at the walls of my cell.
Oh.
I think that those low points, when I hit that point, I realized I need to fight to get out of this.
Mm.
I'm not going to get out of this okay unless I fight for myself, for my sanity, for my life.
Mm.
And even in solitary confinement in the U.S., the suicide rate is twice as high. You literally are fighting for your sanity. So I developed a very disciplined regiment of exercise, prayer, meditation. If I had reading materials, I would memorize and I would perform for an invisible audience. And really creativity and resistance, finding ways to just not let yourself become a part of that place, not let yourself ever feel like I'm a prisoner. Because if you feel like you're a prisoner, then you act like a prisoner, then you're treated like a prisoner, and you become a prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
So passing notes with other women, singing down the hallway, dancing in my cell. Once a guard slapped me and I slapped her back, really never forgetting that you don't belong there is the way to reverse that dehumanization.
Mm. Shane and Josh, let's start with Shane. Did you have similar kinds of experiences? I know you weren't in solitary as long as Sarah, but you were for a while.
Yeah, I mean, I remember times just laying on my back and kind of going through memories and just getting lost. And I would kind of, it's like I would come to almost, and I would know that a bunch of time had passed because this patch of light that was on my wall, the sunlight that was cast through the window had moved, you know, to another part of the cell. I remember, you know, things that I would do to try to stay sane. I had a dictionary at some point, and I learned Morse code, and I would recite poems in Morse code and exercise. I would, you know, drop pieces of food on the ground so that I could watch ants and just kind of study their movements, you know, and how they interacted with each other. And I think one of the most twisted things was that I would every morning hope that my interrogators came when I was in solitary, because I just wanted interaction that badly. And at some point, I really started to wonder whether I was losing my mind, and it was really hard to know, you know, because it was just me. It was just my mind, and I had no context anymore, you know. I had no mm-hmm. people to, like, gauge their reactions to me. There's nothing that I can reflect myself, you know, back from. And I just realized that every kind of social context that I understand is gone, and I'm just kind of floating in an abyss, and it's like, you know, there's no relativity anymore.
Mm. And Josh, how about you?
Yeah, I would express the sentiment of similar desperation. You know, there's kind of ways in which it just feels like endless time. It just, you know, is really misery in a cell. I remember there was one time after 2 months where we got to speak to the Swiss ambassador, who came and spoke to us for a half hour conversation with all three of us and the ambassador. And I didn't go to sleep for days, just totally riled up and overexcited by just that amount of stimulus.
Oh, my goodness.
And there was another instance where I found a pen in my vent and being able to just journal to myself and then write a secret correspondence with Shane for a short bit till we were caught, I would get so excited about this that I would just, again, I wouldn't be able to sleep. And it was, I feel like the deprivation, I couldn't tell what it was until I got an inkling of normal interaction, of like being able to write something or be able to talk to somebody else. And then I could just see what it did to my system.
Mm. Let's welcome phone calls for all of you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The three Americans who were imprisoned in Iran and accused of being spies have written about their experiences in A Sliver of Light, which has just been published, and they are our guests this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can also leave messages for us at talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. First caller is John in Boaz. Hi, John.
Hello?
Yes, John, go ahead.
Hi. I was just interested to hear from your guests. What, if anything, did they learn from this life experience?
All right. What did you learn, Sarah?
Oh, I love that question. I learned that first of all, it's just an incredible gift to get that close to, well, to lose everything, to lose your freedom, then to get it back. And, of course, it highlights what a gift. It makes the rest of your life feel like a gift. And you know, I talk about in prison not wanting to take on the identity of a prisoner. I identify more as an ex-prisoner now, I think, than I did as a prisoner at the time. I'm always in touch with how many people we keep locked up. And our country, the population of D.C., Boston, and Los Angeles combined, that is just an astronomical amount of people. And we can't afford as a society to just write these people off. So I work with an organization called Solitary Watch now. And the use of solitary confinement, having endured 410 days of that, it is just out of control in our prisons. We use it as a routine administrative procedure, and there are so many other ways to have discipline or respond to prison infractions. Many people that end up in solitary haven't even done anything violent. Many of them are mentally ill. So for me, it's not forgetting that the people, not letting prisoners be disappeared.
Shane?
There's so many ways I could answer that question. While I was in prison, the things that I dreamt about were just simplest things, like washing dishes, going for a walk, just sitting and, you know, having a cup of tea with my sister. You know, it was these kind of basic things that are stripped away in prison. So those are things that I really appreciate now. I also I think that I learned, you know, I got an insight into an experience that is fairly common in the world, you know, being wrongfully detained, you know, or being a political prisoner. And, you know, I didn't see myself in a situation where that would have happened, you know. So I have some kind of a new look at and knowledge about what that means, and that informs my entire life, really. Mm-hmm. Not something it's easy to forget about.
Yeah. Josh, how about you?
I guess, you know, one of the takeaways from me is I really embodied and felt what it is to be a statistic. I was one of the three American hikers and, you know, locked up and detained and sure, you know, to the politicians and to the prison guards and to my interrogators, it was all kind of worth it. I was just kind of a political pawn, and it was just part of the political calculus, mm-hmm. Collateral damage, you know. And you know, when it's like watching the news now is a very different experience when you know, 8 civilians get killed in a drone strike, or when, you know, 10 people die in an earthquake or whatever it is. It's real, you know, and it's individuals and it's families and it's part of, you know, this political cost of like a government having an aggressive policy towards the Middle East.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The three Americans who were held in Iranian prison for a long period of time, starting in 2009, are with us this hour. Their book is A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran, and it tells of their captivity. They each take turns almost in a diary-like form, writing about being in solitary confinement, the political situation, the underlings, those who made the decisions to put them in this prison, how they found people who cared about them while they were in prison, and how they cared for each other while they were there. So that's what we're talking about this hour. Our next caller is Tim in Milwaukee. Hello, Tim.
Yeah, hi. My question was, I was wondering what they were doing in the Kurdish area of Iraq while there's a war going on. Now, what I've been led to believe is that they were working in other parts of the Middle East and then decided to vacation in that area and do some hiking. But it doesn't – I'm glad they're safe, don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't – it doesn't seem too smart to, like, go vacationing in a war zone. So I'll hang up and see what you have to say.
All right. Well, let me give that to Sarah, because I know that you realized that you wanted everybody to stop at one point. And so I think you uh-huh. can answer this question.
Sure.
Not going there, but stop your hike for a while.
Right, right. Well, Shane and I were living in Syria for over a year. We had a beautiful home, and I was teaching Iraqi refugees and doing some writing, and Shane was doing journalism. And at that time, Syria was a wonderful, safe place to live. And if you're living in Syria, going to northern Iraq actually does make sense. It's close by. It has beautiful green mountains. And it's also a different culture, the Kurdish culture. And it's almost its own country within Iraq. No American has been killed in northern Iraq or captured in decades. It's not a war zone. It has its own borders, its own language. So we were there for several days visiting castles, eating wonderful food, and learning about the region. And then we saw posters everywhere of a beautiful green place to hike, and everyone told us, go to Ahmadawa, the waterfall. Waterfalls are very popular in the Middle East. Any kind of water is popular. If anything, we made a mistake of hiking too far past where all the people were, and that's why I started to get nervous, because there were hundreds of people camping and enjoying themselves. Over 1 million people come to Kurdistan every year, even Europeans, foreigners, Americans. It's a very pro-American place, but we did hike pretty far.
Mm. And I would just add to that, I've been to Baghdad, and Baghdad, you know, in 2009 was very much a war zone. And I was working as a journalist and was there during election time. And that day, the streets were completely empty. Nobody was allowed to drive. It was too dangerous. And We happened to be in Kurdistan on election day, and it was just a celebration. It was so beautiful. We were out in the streets. Everybody was celebrating. It was just joyous. And, you know, in Baghdad, I met security contractors that said that, American security contractors that said that Kurdistan is where they went to vacation.
Mm-hmm. What about this? I'm trying to figure out the role of these people. The guy who was at the top of the mountain with the gun, the person in this little, like, shack who obviously had all of your lives in his hand. What's the role of these people? Are they trying to be big shots within this bureaucracy that would have them take all of you and eventually you wind up in prison? He could have just said to all three of you, all right, I made my point. I'm having a little fun with you. Now go back down the way you came.
Yeah, I wish they would have.
Yeah, but, well, why didn't they?
I mean, I think, you know, these guys were just kind of regular border guards. A lot of them were really young, and they were just doing their military service, as far as we could tell. And they, you know, they had some kind of far-out post and probably didn't see people coming that way very often. And I think they were surprised, just as surprised as we were, probably. And once they, when they detained us, we were, you know, begging them to let us go back to Iraq. And the commander of the group, there were maybe, I don't know, there were less than 10 people there. He said, well, he'd have to call his boss. And, you know, by the time, once they called to another commander, that it just spiraled. And I think, you know, ultimately they probably, nobody wanted to be responsible for, you know, anybody else finding out that they just let these Americans kind of walk back to the, to Iraq. And then it was out of their hands really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Bob in Sun Prairie. Hi, Bob.
Hey. Yeah, I just kind of had a follow-up on that one question where someone asked them, well, what did you, what was their experience, or how did they feel about this experience once they were free and so forth?
Uh-huh.
And I didn't hear any one of them talk about, well, I think that the United States is a pretty nice place to live. You know, all I heard was kind of political stuff and all that. And I just wondered if they did feel that the United States was nice to get back to or that type of thing.
All right, Bob, thank you. Who wants to respond? Josh?
Sure. You know, the place I was dreaming about and wanted to go, well, many places, there were, a lot of them were in the United States, and my family's here, and this is just where I wanted to be. You know, I felt like, you know, grateful that I wasn't being beaten and all this stuff. And so, you know, in these ways, I was happy to be, you know, I'm very happy to be back in the U.S. If it comes down to, like, you know, if I were in Guantanamo or if I were in solitary confinement for 10, 20, 30 years, like American prisoners are, I wouldn't be too happy to be in the U.S. But, so it's not like, you know, I think the dichotomy of just saying like, okay, you know, the U.S. doesn't do these things. Well, the U.S. doesn't really, beat people in the same way. And I'm very grateful for the U.S. to do that. But the, you know, the enhanced torture, enhanced interrogation techniques that are used, are very much torture and so I'm a fortunate one in the U.S. I'm like extremely grateful for that. Unfortunately, that there are still too many people that that are unfortunate in U.S. custody.
Well, you also, Sarah, let's go to you for this. You also believe, probably all of you, that there is a thread here that part of the reason that the tensions exist and the animosity exists from Iran to the United States is due to American actions?
Sure. Yeah, definitely. I don't agree with my country's foreign policy, aggressive foreign policy in the Middle East. I don't believe anything good has come of it. And I worked with Iraqi refugees. You know, I saw people's lives destroyed for years. And now Syria, the place that I lived and loved, is a horrible war zone. That has nothing, you know, directly to do with the U.S., of course. But I just want to clarify, the political, for me, personal political is very intertwined. I love my country, and there's no doubt coming back here, I missed it so much. And just to lay my eyes on my mother and my home, there's no way to describe how much joy it still gives me every morning to live in this country. But that is, it's not a nationalistic thing. I consider myself to be more of a global citizen. But I guess when it comes to the work that I do now in U.S. prisons, I feel a renewed and increased responsibility for my own country as my home, as the place that I was, you know, shaped and formed. I feel a responsibility to fight against what's wrong here. And when looking at our prisons, it's just something that's affecting our whole society from, you know, from the bottom up.
Mm-hmm. And Shane, how about you?
I love it here. I mean, I was so excited to get back here. And, you know, I have just amazing friends, amazing family. Sarah and I live in California and Oakland. I love the city I live in. There's just so much that I'm grateful for in this country. And, you know, just like Sarah said, you know, I think that makes it so much more important to try to make it better, you know, and try to just, you know, look at the things that are going wrong and not just kind of ignore them. But, mm-hmm. you know, I love this place. I want it to be as good as we can make it.
Why did you decide that you were going to propose to Sarah while you were in prison?
That wasn't my initial intention. I was in solitary confinement, and I decided while I was in solitary, I had been stripped of everything and knew it was just so clear how important Sarah was to me. And I was also at the time reading a lot of Victorian novels that were talking about marriage and people were proposing to each other. So that helped give me some courage. But I had planned on doing it when we got out, you know, and as this kind of way to, you know, start our free lives. But then we start getting some intimations that Sarah might be released before us, before Josh and I. And I knew that if that happened, I didn't know when I would see her again. You know, it could be years. And so, you know, I wanted her to know before she got out that that's what I wanted. So I proposed to her out in this courtyard under the cameras where the guards couldn't watch us.
Oh, my.
And for the record, I was thinking about doing the same thing all those long months.
Were you really?
Yeah.
That's great. Oh, I wish you could have had a movie of that, man. Maybe somebody will do a movie of that. Let's go to Steve in Town River. Hi, Steve.
Hi, my comment probably will take a little bit of different direction. You know, early on, I heard them mention, you know, the kind of, you know, what are we, we're not Guantanamo, you know, kind of using that card, if you will, to get out of, you know, playing into their hand and maybe getting tortured or beaten. And that gives me a little bit of heartburn. The second part of my comment is, you know, I sense that they felt that the president or secretary of state or diplomatic efforts wasn't enough on U.S. behalf to get them out of there in the time that they were there. And I'm pretty critical of that. I think they were in the news. There were certainly a lot of things going on. The third part of the comment is, you know, they seem to be very well-educated, young, fine people. I don't understand how you can take a trip into a dangerous part of the world, whether it's you call it a war zone or not, but without a GPS, without a guide, stumble upon a foreign country, whether you are near it, on it for a minute or off for a minute, and then write a book of your exploitations to profit from. The whole thing sounds, it just sends me the wrong way.
All right. Thanks, Steve, for your call. Josh, we have about a minute left, everybody.
Do you want to take a chance?
Sure. I think we touched on a lot of that, but I would just say that, you know, the media, he mentioned the media, I think the media played a crucial role in our release, and there's no doubt about that. I mean, we got out because of international pressure. This is the media. These were, the government of Iraq, Oman, Venezuela, Muhammad Ali, Sean Penn, I mean, our families. It was a huge, huge effort. There's so many people involved, and we're grateful for that, you know, of course. I mean, we're so lucky. How many people that are imprisoned, wrongfully imprisoned, have that kind of support? I mean, there's no way to repay that.
Yeah. Thank you all so much for being with us, and congratulations on the book. It is just so movingly written and well written. You're all fine writers. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, our pleasure. The book is A Sliver of Light, Three Americans Imprisoned in Iran. Shane Bauer, Joshua Fatal, and Sarah Schrode are the authors. They, as you know, were imprisoned starting in July of 2009 and spent a long, long time in solitary confinement. and write about what that experience was, how you deal with mental lack of stimulation and being by yourself all of that time, and the political situation as well. So it's a good book. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the hour, and to KP as well.